Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Ghosts in the Schoolyard, Racism and School Closings in Chicago's South Side, by Eve L. Ewing, narrated by Lisa Renee Pitts. Publisher's note: this audiobook includes bonus material. Please visit Tantor.com and type Ghosts in the Schoolyard into the search box. Follow the link to the book's page. Then, under the supplemental content section, please enter the access code FAMILY and then click the unlock button to access the bonus material. The code should be entered in all lowercase letters. Tables, graphs, and the appendix referenced in this audiobook can be found in the bonus material. If we must die, oh, let us nobly die, so that our precious blood may not be shed in vain. Then even the monsters we defy shall be constrained to honor us, though dead. Claude McKay. Terms and People. Brizard, Jean-Claude, CEO of Chicago Public Schools from April 2011 to October 2012. Brizard stepped down from his post shortly after the end of a large-scale teacher strike that captured a great deal of local and national media attention. Burns, Will, Alderman of the 4th Ward, which includes much of Bronzeville, from 2011 to 2016, during which time he was embroiled in the fight over Diet High School, as well as other educational issues in the city. Abruptly resigned in 2016 to become an advisor for Airbnb. Bird Bennett, Barbara, CEO of Chicago Public Schools from October 2012 until June 2015. Bird Bennett oversaw the 2013 school closures. She resigned as CEO when it was revealed that she was under federal investigation, and in October 2015, she was indicted on bribery charges for a plan in which she arranged no-bid contracts from the school district to her former mentor and employer in exchange for bribes. As of this writing, she was incarcerated in Alderson Federal Prison. Chicago Board of Education, governing body of Chicago Public Schools, comprising 7 individuals appointed directly by the mayor. In other Illinois school districts, members of the board are chosen in local elections. CEO, Chief Executive Officer of Chicago Public Schools, holding the position known in most other school districts as superintendent. The CEO is appointed directly by the mayor. CHA, Chicago Housing Authority, the agency that oversees public housing across the city. Claypool, Forrest, CEO of Chicago Public Schools from July 2015 until December 2017. Before his appointment as CEO, Claypool had been chief of staff to Mayor Rahm Emanuel. Before that, Emanuel appointed him as head of the Chicago Transit Authority. Claypool also served as Mayor Richard M. Daley's chief of staff from 1989 to 1993. He resigned in 2017 after the district inspector found that he had committed an ethics breach described as a full-blown cover-up. Coalition to Revitalize Diet, a collaborative of partners first advocating for a village of schools designed to closely align Walter H. Diet High School with nearby elementary schools, then protesting the school's closure after it was slated to be shut down by CPS. Coalition members include individual parents, teachers, and community members, as well as organizations such as the Kenwood Oakland Community Organization, Teachers for Social Justice, and the Chicago Botanic Gardens. Diet is pronounced like diet. Daley, Richard J., Mayor of Chicago from 1955 until his death in 1976. Old Man Daley, one of the most powerful politicians in American history, who famously oversaw many of the city's most traumatic and formative years and events, with consequences that have lasted well into the current century, including the rapid rise of public housing. Daley, Richard M., Mayor of Chicago from 1989 to 2011, the eldest son of Richard J. Daley and, like his father, immensely powerful, initiated many educational trends and actions that laid the groundwork for the contemporary school landscape in the city. These actions include taking on complete mayoral control of the school district in 1995 and creating the Renaissance 2010 plan to create 100 new schools, especially through the expansion of charter schools. Launched the Plan for Transformation, a blueprint for demolishing and rebuilding public housing in 1999. Emmanuel Rahm, Mayor of Chicago, elected in May 2011 after Mayor Richard M. Daley's 22-year tenure. As mayor, Emmanuel holds the power to unilaterally appoint the heads of both the CHA and CPS. Widely criticized after both the 2013 school closings and the police shooting of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. Kenwood Oakland Community Organization, KOCO, a membership-based Black community organizing group founded in the 1960s, based in the middle of Bronzeville and active in Dyett High School before, during, and after its planned closure. Several participants in the Dyett hunger strike were also active members of KOCO. Receiving School, Welcoming School, a school designed to receive a group of students after a nearby school is closed, referred to as a welcoming school in official CPS communications. Willis Benjamin, Superintendent of Chicago Public Schools from 1953 until 1966, before the position was known as CEO, criticized by Black parents and civil rights leaders for policies that maintained segregation in CPS. Introduction. We real cool. We left school. We lurk late. We strike straight. We sing sin. We thin gin. We jazz June. We die soon. Gwendolyn Brooks, We Real Cool. Failing schools, underprivileged schools, just plain bad schools. The fodder of tisk, tisk, it's so sad. And that's why we send our kids to private school, and we're so lucky. They're the stuff of legend. Material for inspirational movies and shocking primetime news exposés. In Chicago, they were once famously called the worst in the nation by William Bennett, Secretary of Education under President Ronald Reagan. More recently, Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner called them inadequate, woeful, just tragic, and basically almost crumbling prisons. Chicago's public schools have been positioned in the nation's imagination as, at best, charity cases deserving our sympathy. At worst, they are a malignant force to be ignored if you can, or snuffed out altogether if you can come up with something better. In this sense, Chicago is like many other urban school districts that primarily serve students of color, viewed with pity and contempt. So in 2013, when Mayor Rahm Emanuel announced an unprecedented wave of school closures, perhaps he expected public approval. The city and the school district were facing a $1 billion budget deficit. Enrollment had dropped in the district overall, and many of the schools on the list had long records of low test scores. Chicago Public Schools, CPS, first said that as many as 330 schools could be closed, then pared the number down to 129, and finally announced 54 that made the final list. Of those, 49 ultimately were slated to be closed by the end of the 2012-13 school year. Students attending these schools were assigned seats in other schools nearby. And whatever response Mayor Emanuel and his school's chief, Barbara Bird Bennett, may have expected, they ultimately faced an uproar. Chicago Teachers Union President Karen Lewis publicly called Emanuel the murder mayor. Thousands of Chicagoans took to the streets in 3 days of marches that proceeded from one closing school to the next. Local journalists fact-checking reports demonstrated that the proposed closures would not come near to solving the budget problem. National commentators wrote against the proposed closures. Emanuel was unmoved. On the day the Chicago Board of Education formally approved the closures, his office released a statement. "I know this is incredibly difficult, but I firmly believe the most important thing we can do as a city is provide the next generation with a brighter future." Bird Bennett, appearing before the board to push them toward a vote, called the move imperative and said that we can no longer embrace the status quo. But if the schools were so terrible, why did people fight for them so adamantly? In the hazy cataloging of my literary mind, "We Real Cool" is the first line from a poem I can remember. To grow up as a school child in Chicago is to know the name of Gwendolyn Brooks, most likely as the woman who wrote the short poem that starts with a group of real cool young people leaving school and ends with their early deaths. Brooks was the first African-American to win a Pulitzer Prize, and she was the poet laureate of Illinois. But to many, she will be remembered best as the Bard of Bronzeville, the historically black community on Chicago's South Side that she called home. Bronzeville has been lucky in this way, blessed with an undue share of storytellers and dream keepers, poets and bluesmen, journalists and freedom fighters. A review of their names like St. Clair Drake, Ida B. Wells, and Nat King Cole, makes trying to tell a Bronzeville story seem like a foolish errand. What narrative could match their example? In a 1983 reading, Brooks described her motivation for the poem. She was passing a pool hall one afternoon and saw a group of young boys inside. She said, "Instead of asking myself, why aren't they in school, I asked, I wonder how they feel about themselves." It is this sort of question, with its attention to agency, to speaking one's own truth, and to the presumption that a community may contain within its own wisdom the answers to its many conundrums, that has made me brave or unwise enough to try to write the chapters that follow. While they represent many hours of reading, reflection, and questioning, they also, much like Brooks's poem, result from one fundamental moment of dissonance. Chicago is my home. I grew up here, went to public schools here, and attended college here. After I graduated, I became a public school teacher in Bronzeville. I have my fair share of startling memories from growing up in the city that shaped me, but one of the most jarring moments I ever encountered took place when I was away from home. It was 2013. I had left the classroom for graduate school, and I was visiting my father in Florida on spring break. I was alone, sitting on the edge of the bed with the door closed, my grip tightening on the glowing rectangle of my phone as I read a Chicago Sun-Times article listing the Chicago public schools that would be closing at the end of the school year. When I got to the school in Bronzeville where I'd been a teacher, I had to read and reread it and read it again to be sure I wasn't missing something. Surely this was a mistake. How could our school be on a list like this? I thought of each of my colleagues in bewilderment, thought of my principal and our students and the many hours we had all dedicated to providing a quality education. My eyes flicked upward to the statement from the superintendent, Barbara Bird Bennett. In Chicago, this position is referred to as the Chief Executive Officer, the CEO. CEO Bird Bennett had been quoted as saying, "I believe that every child in every community in Chicago deserves access to a high-quality education that will prepare them for success in college, career, and in life. I believe that that's the purpose of public schools. But for too long, children in certain parts of our city have been cheated out of the resources they need to succeed in the classroom because they are trapped in underutilized schools. These underutilized schools are also under-resourced." Two words emerged that I also read over and over. The schools, she said, were underutilized and under-resourced. "But," I said aloud, "that doesn't make any sense. How could the person charged with doling out resources condemn an institution for not having enough resources?" I read it again, then again, growing sadder and angrier and more confused. And then there was the question of race. Of the students who would be affected by the closures, 88% were Black. 90% of the schools were majority Black, and 71% had mostly Black teachers. A big deal in a country where 84% of public school teachers are white. In the coming weeks, the explanations the district offered struck me as inconsistent at best and illogical at worst, and left me tongue-tied when my fellow education researchers at Harvard asked me to clarify exactly what was happening in Chicago. The researcher in me was intrigued and puzzled. The teacher in me was mourning. And the Chicagoan in me, witness to a seemingly bottomless tradition of corruption, political abuse, and dishonesty, was skeptical. At the intersection of these identities, I became obsessed with teasing out something deeper. What role did race, power, and history play in what was happening in my hometown? Behind the numbers and the maps and the graphs, who were the people, the teachers, the children, the neighbors, who would be affected by the decision to close so many schools? And, as Brooks asked, how did they feel about themselves, about their lives, about the machinations of the city around them, about hope or despair? I chased the story to boarded-up schools and dusty library archives, to City Hall and to Saturday picnics, to the empty lots where public housing projects once stood, and to the brown brick complexes where they remained. When I felt I'd answered one question, it inevitably led me to another. Early on, when I asked a principal I knew and trusted to describe the school closure process, he took a sharp breath before calling it a headlong rush into a spinning fan. This characterization could also describe my research process. And to orient myself, I tried to always keep an eye on the center so as to understand the rapid movement happening around me. As such, the four chapters of the book represent four different methodological approaches, all based on research conducted between January 2015 and January 2016. Field observations, document analyses, review of audio transcripts, and interviews with community members. Though the approaches differ, they all aim to answer the same larger question: why do people care so much about schools that the world has deemed to be failing? If these institutions are supposedly so worthless, why do people fight to save them? This story unfolds against the backdrop of Chicago, my beautiful, hideous, deeply flawed, lovely, violent, endearing, maligned, beloved hometown. It's a city frequently noted as one of the most persistently segregated places in the nation, a towering metropolis built on a foundation of housing discrimination and violence. The city is not only a setting, but a character, a force acting in its own ways to influence the lives of the people who live here. This book focuses on the school closures in Bronzeville. This community on the city's majority Black South Side saw four schools slated for closure in 2013, including the school where I'd taught. And since 1999, it has had 16 schools either closed or entered into a turnaround process, where all faculty and staff lose their jobs and the school is turned over to a third party to hire new teachers. In some ways, Bronzeville could be considered typical of African American communities of our era. The fortunes of the community have risen and fallen with the broader tide of social forces affecting Black urban centers across the country, including segregation, housing policy, school policy, and economic trends, what sociologist William Julius Wilson calls cycles of deprivation. At the same time, Bronzeville is special. Beginning about 20 blocks south of downtown Chicago, bounded by Lake Michigan and the Dan Ryan Expressway, the region occupies a singular place as Chicago's historic hub of African American culture. The community was the destination of thousands of migrants heading to Chicago from southern states during the Great Migration and home to luminaries such as Richard Wright and Gwendolyn Brooks. While the rest of the world might consider it something like the Harlem of Chicago, my stubborn second city heritage forbids me such an analogy. If anything, I might insist that Harlem is the Bronzeville of New York City. Bronzeville is also special to me. As an African-American woman writer, born and raised in the city, I have long held the cultural legacy of the community as a source of identity and an inspiration, which is why I felt so fortunate to teach in a school there. Since I have now admitted my personal, even emotional, interest in school closure, as well as my preoccupation with questions of justice and social change, some listeners may protest that my recounting of this narrative will not be objective. Indeed, the story is not an objective one. I am not an objective observer, nor do I aspire to be. As critical race theorists have argued, claims to objectivity often serve as a camouflage for the self-interest, power, and privilege of dominant groups in U.S. society. What's more, such theorists would argue, and I would agree, that the experiential knowledge of people of color not only is a legitimate source of evidence, but it is, in fact, critical to understanding the function of racism as a fundamental American social structure. So I cannot and do not aspire to tell an objective story. Rather, I offer a story that is revelatory based on the experience of my own life and the lives of community members living in the shadow of history. 2013 school closings. What we already know. There has not been a great deal of research on the CPS school closings, but what we do know helps us understand the big picture beyond Bronzeville. First, and perhaps most important, we know that the students affected by school closure tend to be some of the city's most vulnerable. Researchers have found that the closed schools serve disproportionately vulnerable student populations compared with the rest of the district, including more low-income students, more students who moved often, more students who had repeated a grade at least once, and more students who received special education services. In 2009, researchers conducted an analysis to see whether students received academic benefits after their schools closed. After all, this was, and still is, a common argument presented in favor of school closings. Won't the students end up at superior schools and so be better off than at their old schools? As it turns out, not really. Researchers compared 5,445 CPS students aged 8 and older whose schools were closed from 2001 to 2006 with a group of students at similar schools. There was no real change in these students' math or reading outcomes, and they were just as likely to be held back or referred for special education. But worse, the authors found that students attending closed schools had experienced a drop in academic achievement during the year before the school actually closed, amid the turmoil of the announcement. Once students and teachers found out their schools were closing, it was hard to stay academically on track for the rest of the year. News of school closings hurt students' performance, and moving to new, supposedly better schools didn't help. So what happened after the students were relocated? The results vary depending on the quality of the new school. Students who moved to the city's lowest performing schools saw losses in reading and math, while students who enrolled in the city's top performing schools saw small gains. But the first group, those relocated to schools in the bottom quarter of test score rankings, was much larger. Of the displaced students, 42% went to the lowest ranked schools and only 6% ended up in top ranked schools. And of that small group, most students had to travel a significant distance to get to their new schools, an average of 3.5 miles. In other words, the argument that school closings can be good because students will end up in better schools is theoretically possible. But research suggests that this happens only for students who find themselves relocating to top-tier schools, which turns out to be a very small percentage, and those children on average have to go very pretty far from home to get to the new school. The reality is that students who experience school closure end up at new schools that are not thriving academically, so they don't receive any boost or improvement in their education. This makes sense, because the history of segregation and inequality has left struggling schools largely clustered together across the landscape, meaning that students leaving a school facing challenges are likely to end up in an equally challenged school close by. Perhaps informed by these findings, during the 2013 closings, CPS officials decided that for each closing school, there would be a higher-performing, welcoming school for students to attend, though in practice, parents did not have to enroll their children in this designated receiving school. After the 2013 closings, 2/3 of CPS students attended their designated receiving schools. 1/4.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?